I'm Andrew O'Hagan, host of a new podcast from the London Review of Books. It's about the bloodiest and most controversial event of the Falklands War, the sinking of the General Belgrano. Margaret Thatcher was accused of a war crime. The truth would only emerge in the pages of a private diary. This is the Belgrano Diary. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.
Hello, I'm Thomas Jones, host of the LRB podcast, and before we begin today's episode, I'd like to tell you about Bluettes, a play opening next month at the Royal Court Theatre in London, starring Ben Whishaw, Emma Darcy, and Kayla Michael. Based on Maggie Nelson's book, Bluettes is a meditation on love and grief, a story about depression and desire, pleasure and pain, and a person obsessed with the colour blue. It's adapted for the stage by Margaret Perry and directed by Katie Mitchell, and it runs at the Royal Court from the 17th of May to the 29th of June. Click on the link in the description to book tickets. You're listening to the London Review of Books podcast. I'm Thomas Jones. Today I'm speaking with Pooja Bhatia, who teaches in the University Network for Human Rights and has a piece in the latest issue of the paper on the difficulties faced by Haitian refugees trying to get to the United States. Hello, Pooja, and thank you very much for joining me today.
Hi, Tom. Thank you for having me.
So maybe we should begin, I guess, with the reasons, or some of the many reasons, old and new, that people are having to flee Haiti.
There are a lot of reasons, certainly. I would say that the current wave of immigration started in 2010 after the earthquake. I think that the immigration, people leaving Haiti, reflects not just or even mostly that terrible catastrophe, but also the fact that their options for political action have been really foreclosed. It is hard for a lot of Haitians to find a livelihood, to find a decent life in Haiti, and it has gotten progressively worse over the past 14 years. After the assassination of President Jovenel Moïse in July 2021, gangs and armed groups gained increasing control over the capital, Port-au-Prince. By January of 2024, it was estimated that these armed groups slash gangs controlled about 80% of the capital, and they made life impossible for people who wanted to live a normal life, you know, and this ranged from fears of being kidnapped, which was a way for people to be basically decapitalized, right? So they might have savings, they might have managed to buy a house. They might have managed to put some money away somewhere. And if they were kidnapped, or if a family member or associate were kidnapped, then they probably would have to use some portion of their savings, if not all of it, to pay the ransom. So the kidnapping had an element of financial terror as well as mortal terror. That was one aspect. For people who were in politics and who opposed the Moïse regime, things became incredibly dodgy. There were assassinations of human rights advocates. There were arbitrary detentions of people for allegedly plotting coups. There were massacres in bastions of a Moïse opposition. So on all levels, whether you were trying to live a normal life, trying to send your children to school, trying to go to work, or whether you were actually trying to change the country for the better, life became extremely perilous for Haiti. And so people have left in droves.
And in September last year, as you write in the piece, you made a visit to a refugee camp in Mexico on the US border, where you met a woman who you call M. The letter M, to protect her identity, presumably. Is her story typical?
I would say that it is not unusual. I think that her story was that she was a market seller. So she, you know, these women are the backbone of Haiti's economy, which is largely informal. and they will go and buy goods wholesale. And by goods, I mean, in her case, in Em's case, she bought foodstuffs. So bouillon cubes, garlic, cooking oil. She would buy these in bulk and then sell them retail back in her hometown. She, on one of her buying trips, was assaulted and robbed. She was beaten very severely. She lost all of her money, which she had borrowed at a very high rate of interest, as was common for her. And then when she fled, she was trying to heal from her injuries and was pressured to testify against the men who had beaten and robbed her. And that prospect was what drove her out of the country. She felt that, you know, aside from being beaten, aside from being decapitalized, the prospect of getting justice against these men or the people who directed their efforts, their crimes, was effectively nil, and that she would suffer even more for trying to do it. So she went to Chile.
And this was all several years ago. This was 2017.
That's right. So what we are seeing, one of the interesting things about Haitians fleeing Haiti over the past 10, 15 years is that they are taking, they're not going directly to the United States or to places in the Caribbean as they once did on boats. Now, you know, after 2010 and the earthquake, Brazil and later Chile became very welcoming to Haitian workers. Brazil was hosting the World Cup, and then it would be hosting the Olympics. And so it had a lot of big infrastructure projects for which it needed labor. And Chile's economy in the early part of the 2010s was likewise booming. So, you know, for instance, in 2017, some 100,000 Haitians left Haiti to go to Chile, where they could get a visa on arrival and get a decent job and accumulate some savings. But that's, again, like staggering numbers.
But then
then the welcome wore out. I think that especially in Chile, which had been a very, very white country, I think that Haitians were at first greeted with a kind of welcome. And then as more and more of them arrived, it seems that the welcome wore out. And 2018, well, until 2018, Haitians could get a visa on arrival, and finding a work visa as well was pretty easy. But that started to change with the election of Sebastian Piñera in 2018. He was conservative. You know, he did the kind of Mitt Romney, I think, famously suggested in the United States is voluntary deporting, that immigrants who are undocumented might voluntarily deport themselves. Well, that was what Piñera suggested too. And, you know, some hundreds of people did it.
Did that change at all when Gabriel Boric was elected in 2022?
Not that I know of. Not that I know of. So for instance, when I was at the border, at the U.S.-Mexico border, I met a lot of people, a lot of Haitians who had made the journey from Chile or other parts of South America. And they had made that journey by bus, by foot in the Darien Gap, by boat, by, you know, canoe.
And it's an immensely long journey, isn't it? I mean, it's thousands of miles, right?
It's thousands of miles, yes. I think it was 7,000 miles. You know, it's like along the route of the Pan-American Highway, which is supposed to go from the south of the Americas to the north of it. But there's a spot between Colombia and Panama, between South America and Central America, where there is no road, right? That's called the Darien Gap. And that has become a major crossing route for people who are on the move. It also is incredibly dangerous, or has been incredibly dangerous, with, you know, not just the kind of hazards of that arduous trek, but also sexual violence and other types of assaults.
And then those who do make it all the way to the US border then have to stop and wait.
They have to wait, exactly. So a lot of the people that I met had left Chile. They had left Chile in, you know, 2022, 2023,
And so, you know, they had decided that it was no longer a really hospitable place for them. They felt that there was one man that I spoke to, a young guy, about 30, who, you know, felt that to the extent he had managed to achieve and build a life for himself in Chile, you know, with an apartment, a dog, his car, he felt the racism very intensely. And he felt also that when Haitian friends of his were harassed, or in two instances, he recounted to me, even carjacked, the problem was that the Chilean police wouldn't lift a finger to do anything. So again, you know, he felt very sorely the absence of the protection of law. And that was when he decided to come northward to the United States. At the border, you know, the Biden administration, it's very, very, very difficult to be a Haitian who is fleeing Haiti. Things are not easy. That said, Biden's policy toward Haitians has not been as bad as it has been for other groups. So, you know, there is this program of humanitarian parole by which I believe some 120,000 people have been able to come from Haiti to the United States for a period of 2 years. And that's complicated. There are problems with this issue of humanitarian parole. It's all liminal status, and who knows what will happen when, you know, there's a change, if there is a change in administration.
And also it's for 2 years, but what happens when those 2 years are up?
Exactly. That's not clear yet. It's not clear. There are, you know, there are hundreds of thousands of Haitians and people from other nationalities as well who have these liminal statuses. There's a think tank that calls them twilight statuses because they are inherently precarious. And these are grants of parole that are, you know, they won't lead to a green card. They do not lead to an automatic work permit, and they offer scant protection against, you know, a change in administration.
Parole, I mean, it makes it sound a little bit like you're getting out of jail, but it's why is it called parole? Is it is it like you give your word?
No, it has, I don't think it has anything to do with parole as in speech. I think it is connected to the punitive aspect of immigration and immigration policies. So parole refers to, you are given a grant of parole from deportation proceedings. So when you enter at the border, you get this parole. People who enter at the border claiming asylum would also get what's called a notice to appear. And this is a document that tells them a date and a court in which they have to appear to argue their case against deportation. What makes the Biden administration a little more, I mean, I don't think it's intentional, but what has made it a bit more humane in practice so far is that these notices to appear are usually scheduled for, the immigration system is in such a terrible state of backlog and understaffing that, you know, people typically have a notice to appear 2 years or 3 years after they enter.
If you enjoy the LRB podcast, you might also enjoy the We Society podcast from the Academy of Social Sciences. In each episode, Will Hutton untangles the grand challenges we face as a society, looking at them from a social science perspective. Will has gathered some of the UK's most groundbreaking and influential social scientists to ask how their research could help solve some of the country's most pressing problems. In Season 5, the We Society tackles Britain's ailing high streets, bankrupt councils, and the continued lack of disability inclusion, among other important topics. So, if you want to hear research-led insights and solutions and a great conversation, listen and subscribe to the We Society wherever you get your podcasts. And so, I mean, the temptation to disappear must be quite strong, presumably. Once you're in the US, if you can get a job that pays cash and so on, I mean, there must be quite a strong temptation not to appear.
Just to not appear, right? Right. I imagine so. You know, that said, it isn't easy to sort of live under the table to work under the table in the United States. A lot of people who have especially recently arrived have a very hard time finding a livelihood and finding any means to support themselves.
And getting in illegally, as it's called, although I mean, I don't really like that way of talking about it, but getting in, crossing the border unofficially is almost impossible now. I mean, those stories about, you know, the governor of Texas putting saw blades in the Rio Grande and so on to stop people crossing. Is that, do people still try and make the crossing unofficially?
Oh, yes. Yes, for sure. So in the case of Haitians, and I focused on Haitians because I was very interested in this new route that people were taking through South America and Central America and Mexico to the United States. But for Haitians, people have been more or less able to get an appointment for what's called an inspection at a port of entry. And they do it on this app that this is called the CBP1 app that the government launched about a year ago. And it provides a process for scheduling the inspection that you have at a port of entry, where you would get your, you would have a screening for asylum. You would receive a document that says that you have parole and that gives you a notice to appear in court at a future date. So for Haitians, they had been getting appointments on this app and had been able to enter, not illegally, but with authorization. Now, there are a lot of other people who have not been able to get appointments on the app, who have not been able to schedule inspections. And the process for who gets to schedule an inspection is actually incredibly opaque. Now that you have an app, you know, we don't know what is actually, what are the, how these inspections are being meted out. So for a lot of people, they will cross or try to cross and with the intent of turning themselves into Border Patrol and declaring asylum. But, you know, there are a lot of people, as you said, in Texas especially, where Governor Greg Abbott has this thing called Operation Lone Star, which is a state response to what they see as an immigration crisis. And it involves, as you mentioned, you know, these really terrible saw-like blades on buoys in the Rio Grande and, you know, quite a lot of barbed wire. He's trying to deputize the Texas police to, you know, basically deport people or to get people into border proceedings. So
if you do ask for asylum, claim asylum, I mean, a lot of people, I mean, I think you do give the figure in the piece. I mean, it's incredibly low, the number of people who are awarded asylum.
Yeah. For Haitians, it's lower. But for, I mean, I think for everybody, it's, you know, something like it's been historically about 50% of the cases that actually get through the adjudication process, 50% of the cases that the claims are denied. Now, you have to keep in mind that there's an incredible amount of attrition between the people who come to the United States or screen for asylum, say they want to seek asylum and go, and, you know, I mean, people are just like dropping out of the process throughout, right? Because the asylum process is incredibly costly. You need a lawyer. There's a lot of, there are a lot of barriers to entry, no pun intended.
But in this question that legally, as those decisions show, that there is this distinction between, I mean, it's true in the UK and in the rest of Europe as well, that there is this distinction between asylum seekers and so-called economic migrants that the right wing, and well, not only the right wing in Britain, likes to call bogus asylum seekers. But in reality, the difference isn't so clear-cut, is it? I mean, the people you spoke to in those camps, if you're fleeing, if you can't make a living, if you're being robbed and all the rest of it, then even if you don't meet the very high legal threshold to be an asylum seeker, you still, the idea that, oh, this idea that people, oh, they're just economic migrants, is a false distinction, isn't it?
Right. It's a very, very, it's a false dichotomy. For the most part. So I think that at least it's a very troubling dichotomy that needs to be troubled, because in the United States, at least, asylum law will protect people who can demonstrate that they have a credible fear of persecution based on their membership in a social or political or religious group. So basically, based on their ideology or their identity. But what if you're fleeing generalized violence in your country, right? Like, what if you are, why is an asylum claim not, you know, why can't we consider all Haitians as being persecuted? Because basically that's what's happening right now in Port-au-Prince, right? People are living in mortal fear. And, you know, I mean, one could argue, I guess, I'm sure that this argument has been shot down over and over that, you know, that being Haitian is a political status. It is a political identity. So why can't that qualify automatically for refugee status?
And there's also the question, and again, this doesn't come into grants of asylum, but the extent to which the US or a succession of US governments have been responsible for the crisis in Haiti.
Oh, yeah. I'm so glad that you brought that up. You know, one of the things that I mentioned in the piece is that the Homeland Secretary Alejandro Mayorkas has been, you know, he's been hounded by reporters over the past couple of years and, you know, lawmakers who want him to admit that there is a crisis at the border, right? This, you know, the border is overrun, there's an invasion. And, you know, actually, I would argue that he should just say, yes, there is a crisis at the border, but then define it. And in a lot of ways, the crisis at the border is the crisis of U.S. policy in South Central America, in the Caribbean, in Haiti, certainly. And it's coming. It's coming to our border, you know?
And that, I mean, there's that thing that for the, I mean, there are two things. I mean, we can go all the way back to when Aristide was overthrown in a coup in 1991. And then there's the question of, you know, Clinton and the rice. But they're two different questions, I guess.
Yes. United States policy has played a huge role in making it hard for Haitians to find a life in their country. And the example that you're referring to was that in 1991, there was a coup against Aristide, who had been in power then for 7 months, you know, and he was the first democratically elected president in Haiti. He was a liberation theologian. He was a socialist, you know, at least, and maybe left of that. He was beloved because the vast majority of Haitians at that point had been incredibly disenfranchised. I mean, not just literally, but, you know, I mean, they were not full members of society. Aristide promised them a seat at the table. And so, you know, he was deposed in a coup that was abetted by America's CIA in 1991. Bill Clinton became president in 1992. And, you know, he wanted to work really hard on restoring Aristide to the presidency in Haiti. Aristide ended up spending about 3 years in exile as negotiations took place between, there's a junta that took over and there was a lot of dodgy narco trafficking, a lot of repression of Aristide's supporters. And when Aristide came back, he was forced to, it was on condition that he accept a whole bunch of the structural adjustment reforms that were then in vogue. So privatizing public enterprises and eliminating tariffs on rice. Agricultural tariffs. And this had the effect of, you know, flooding the Haitian market with cheap, subsidized product from American rice farmers, you know, and Haitian farmers just couldn't compete. And so then you have increasing and accelerating urbanization because people can no longer have a decent life in the countryside. And in some ways that's part of what made the 2010 earthquake, which struck Port-au-Prince, so terribly fatal. You know, that's why there were so many deaths. It's because people have been packed into tiny Port-au-Prince in structures that really aren't meant to last.
And also the country doesn't have food security anymore.
Oh, yeah. There's that too, right?
You know, and that quote, I mean, you've quoted it before, I think, but that from Clinton, that, you know, it may have been good for some of my farmers in Arkansas, but it has not worked. I have to live every day with the consequences of the lost capacity to produce a rice crop in Haiti. As if you, and it, but it's so, I don't know that he has to live with it. He's kind of, oh, poor Bill. What about the Haitian rice farmers who have to live with not quite any rice? But anyway. And that's, I mean, the question of invasion. It's such an offensive term anyway, but when it's, you know, it's the same in Europe when you have former colonial powers talking about people coming from countries which really were invaded by the British.
Exactly.
And still, you know, with the consequences of colonization and post-colonization and so on. I mean, that rhetoric of invasion, I mean, it's almost like Clinton presenting himself as the victim somehow. It's kind of, it's turning on its head the question of who is whose victim, really.
Yeah. The invasion thing is really kind of, it's very galling, very galling. You know, I lived in Haiti for 4 years, and that was not during a time when the U.S. Marines were there, although they, you know, there was a 19-year occupation that began in 1915, and in 2004, there had been, you know, a deployment of Marines. I guess after the earthquake, they did send in the U.S. military for a brief time. But of course, there was MINUSTAH, the peacekeeping force that the United States largely paid for, that many Haitians considered an occupation. And there were, after the earthquake, there were a gazillion aid workers who were very handsomely paid, and it showed, right? So they had very fancy cars, SUVs, and they went to nice restaurants, and, you know, often driving past, or in some cases even walking past Haitians who had been displaced by the earthquake and were, you know, living in tents. So this question of who is invading whom is an important one. I do think that the rhetoric, I will say, I do think that the rhetoric of invasion, of this, you know, poisoning the blood, has really affected Americans. Like, it's really primed Americans for this sort of thinking, the sort of anti-immigrant thinking, that it isn't rooted in fact, it isn't rooted in everyday experience, but somehow the fear is there.
Yeah, and I think, I mean, it's been shown, hasn't it, that often the fear of immigration tends to be highest in communities with very low or even non-existent immigrant populations. That, I mean, you in the piece, you talk about the woman in Iowa, who's, yes. Which is a long way from the Rio Grande.
It is. I was especially interested in that because, you know, I'm American, but my parents came to the United States from India, and they settled in Iowa, about 90 miles from where that sweet-hearted woman was talking about her fear of immigrants. And it was, you know, it's not the America that my parents came to in a lot of ways, right? I mean, what do the immigrants want to do? What do the Haitians want to do? They want to work. They want to be your home healthcare aide. They want to, like, work for wages that Americans will not work for, and they want to do it legally. Sounds like an invasion to me.
Yeah, I mean, on that question, you wrote a piece after the assassination of the president in 2021, and you mentioned a very important person in that piece was a friend of yours in Haiti. And at the end, you says that she wrote to you and asking, you know, saying a lot of people are going to the American embassy to ask for asylum. They say, if you know someone, you can do it. Should I go? I mean, she was trained as a nurse, right? So there's a, you know, here we have someone who wants to come to America, can work as a nurse. Did she try to come?
She got her passport last year, and that was quite a thing. You know, so many people had been trying to leave Haiti that passports became a major racket. I think that, you know, she ended up getting one for her and her husband, her then husband. I think they cost something like $400 each just for this document that, you know, attests to your nationality. And that was because of the corruption. That was because of various rackets. So she did end up getting a passport, and she has applied for this program. She has a sponsor for the Biden program, the humanitarian parole program. It is not true that if you go to the embassy, as she had hoped, that you could get asylum. And in fact, there was this very poignant
episode that didn't make it into the piece, but I don't think it made it into the piece, but in August 2023, back up for a second, because of the gangs that have been terrorizing Port-au-Prince, many people had been displaced. It's something like the latest statistic I saw is something like 400,000 people in Haiti have been displaced, the vast majority of them in Port-au-Prince. And so some of them have been doubly displaced or triply displaced. And in August 2023, when things were getting particularly bad, one of those troughs, a group of displaced people went to the American embassy outside of Port-au-Prince and basically sat up there, right? They like stayed outside the embassy. They wanted to try to get some protection. And, you know, a couple days later, the Haitian National Police dispersed them by tear gas. So there's a very clear signal that America is not here to, is not there to protect you, right? Even now, you know, the United States is, you know, deportations continue. I saw recently that I think the IOM reported that some countries, not just the United States, but also probably the Bahamas and the Dominican Republic and, you know, supposed friends and neighbors in the Caribbean have deported some 13,000 people back to Haiti, back to this situation over the past month. That's just one month. The United States, as far as I know, is trying to deport Haitians, trying to continue a regime of deportations, but it's not able to because the airport is closed. The airport in Port-au-Prince is closed. So,
which, you know, if you want a sign that it's not safe to send people
correct.
Back,
correct.
I mean, the other thing we should say about MINUSTAH that when they were there, that they brought cholera into the country, and there were a lot of instances of sexual violence, right, carried out by them. I mean, they really did the opposite of helping.
Yes, it's all connected, right? It's all connected. I think that one of the difficult things about the cholera is that the United Nations and MINUSTAH never made adequate apology and certainly not reparations. I think that Ban Ki-moon in, you know, 2016 kind of acknowledged that the UN had played a role, the UN's negligence and recklessness in setting up its peacekeeping base, you know, and then they have troops from cholera endemic countries like Nepal, and they weren't testing the troops for cholera. And as it turned out, the sewage system at this base was really inferior, and they ended up leaking cholera bacteria waste into the tributary of a major river, killing at least 10,000 Haitians in that go-around, but the figure is probably at least 30,000. Right now, cholera has reemerged in Haiti. At a time when hospitals have shut down, when it's extra, extra, extra hard and perilous to get people the treatment that they need, which is actually really basic, consisting of clean water and rehydration. So it's all very upsetting.
Put on a slightly more positive note, that the two people who you write about in the piece who you met in these different camps on the Mexico-US border last autumn, are both now in the US or did both get to the US?
Yes. So one of them, the woman who is M, she and her husband made it to Florida where they have family. And she was, you know, and living with family is great. There are a lot of Haitians in Florida. And I'm sure, I mean, it's not easy, but it's certainly better than what a lot of other recent arrivals to the United States are having to do. And then the man that's in the piece, I think I call him D, he went to New York. Another, you know, there are a lot of Haitians in New York as well. He had a couple of friends there. I think he received his work permit, which is great. I think that not being able to work was really bumming him out. You know, I think one thing that I note in the piece that he arrived in New York on the same day that the mayor of New York, Eric Adams, made this big speech warning that immigrants were going to destroy New York City, which was jarring for a lot of people and New Yorkers to hear.
Well, most New Yorkers.
Right. Right. He said it. I don't know if he said it in the backdrop of the Statue of Liberty, but, you know. But, you know, I mean, the truth is that the vast majority of people who are coming here are not interested in being
in being, you know, a burden on the state. They're not people are people. They're not interested in going to a place where they're not welcome and they can't take care of themselves. And they have come to the United States believing that there will be opportunity, that there will be jobs. And in fact, the United States does have a labor shortage, and immigrants play an incredibly important role in that, in, you know, easing labor shortages. So long story short, he was really bummed out when he didn't have authorization to work. He had a hard time finding a decent paying job that would, you know, afford him some sort of protections. But now that he has a work permit, he's much more optimistic about it. Yeah.
And there's also, it almost doesn't need saying, but we'll say it in the same, you know, that this question of the way the United States treats asylum seekers and immigrants, Britain and the rest of Europe really are no better. And in the same issue of the paper as your piece, there's a piece by Frances Weber about, she writes about the case of Ibrahim Abar, who's a young Senegalese man who was sentenced to 9.5 years in prison for gross negligence manslaughter and facilitating illegal entry to the UK after being held criminally responsible for the drowning of at least 4 people. The bodies of 5 others were never found after a dinghy collapsed in the English Channel. And the judge accepted that Barr, whose age is a matter of dispute, but who was definitely a teenager at the time of the crossing, had been coerced and threatened into agreeing to steer the death trap dinghy. And survivors in the dinghy described him trying to save people, but he was still sent to jail. So, and meanwhile, thousands of people die in the Mediterranean trying to get to southern Europe. There are 100,000 people that are detained for immigration reasons in the EU every year. So European listeners and readers should not feel complacent about, you know, their situation, our situation, compared to the US. That question of children that you met, there was a 10-year-old boy who you met whose mother was in the US and he was trying to join her, and I worry about him.
Yeah, he made it to his mom, and I spoke to his mom after he had arrived. That was a huge relief. That was heartbreaking and terrifying to sort of meet him and think about his situation. So we met him in Tijuana. His mother had received humanitarian parole into the United States, and she wanted her son to join her. And so she entrusted, you know, she got him a flight to Mexico, where she believed that he would be in the care of someone reliable. For whatever reason, that person let her down, and her son, 10 years old, ended up staying with someone who is not, you know, like basically a stranger to him. It's not clear if he was abused, but he certainly wasn't treated well enough that he wanted to stay. And one day he left. And meanwhile, his mother is paying, you know, she was paying, I believe, you know, $500 a month for his care and so on. And he just left. Tiny little 10-year-old boy, you know, and he went to the border and he tried to cross. And, you know, at that point he was detained by the Mexican authorities and he was sent to a state, kind of like an orphanage for children. And they have a variety of They have children from a variety of places there, including Mexican children. And he languished there for about 6 months, even though he, you know, I mean, he said that, oh, I'm sorry, not 6 months, 6 weeks. He said that when we met him, he was in the care, or we interviewed him in the presence of one of the officials at the orphanage. And he said in Creole, which the official couldn't understand, that they could have reached his mom much earlier because she was on Facebook and he, you know, would have provided the name. In the meantime, the mother she received a phone call from someone who claimed to have her son and said that he could help the child cross and make it to her in Florida if she paid him, wired him, you know, $1,100 or something. And she, of course, did that as soon as she could. And then the person disappeared and was, you know, she was going wild with fear and worry. And she saw on television, she saw the number for this advocacy, this legal organization that called Haitian Bridge Alliance. And she,
you know, contacted them, and eventually through their networks, they located her son. And then it was another, I think it was another probably 3 or 4 weeks after we met him that he finally made it back home.
And that is the Haitian Bridge Alliance that you went with?
Yes. They're an amazing organization. They began in, I think, about 2015 or 2016 when Haitians began to appear at, you know, at the southern border in Tijuana for the first time.
And I mean, the language problem is clearly, I mean, the language question is clearly can be a problem, that you have people who speak Creole. Many other people trying to cross the border from elsewhere in Latin America will speak Spanish and they'll be able to communicate with the Mexican officials. But people coming from Haiti, especially if they haven't spent a lot of time in Chile and learned Spanish, will have communication problems.
Yeah, for sure.
I mean, the other thing that keeps coming up, just there's so many instances in your piece of people, vulnerable people with very little money, just being fleeced for hundreds of dollars.
Oh, it's a cottage industry. And then, it's a corrupt cottage industry, and it doesn't stop once you are authorized to come into the United States, because you have to fill out a work permit application. These forms are not in Creole, right? They're intimidating. And of course, there are consultants or notaries, stealth-styled notaries, who are so eager to take your money and help you. And that, by the way, goes for asylum cases too, right? There's a lot of fleecing that happens there as well.
Yeah, when you talk, and the guy in Brooklyn that he, you know, they paid a deposit on a flat and then the money disappears, the flat disappears.
Right. It just evaporates. There are a lot of deposits that seem to disappear.
You know, this question of, you know, the Creole phrase, cherche la vie, people are looking for a livelihood or for life, and they, or, you know, a way of making a living, looking for a way to make a living. And that's what they're coming to America for. It's difficult now, but in the longer term, is it a more positive prospect?
I don't know. Yeah, maybe. I hope so. I really hope so. I think a lot of it depends on the election. And, you know, Trump, if Trump comes back to office and, you know, he is really using this immigration issue, we're trying to get as much, he's trying to galvanize the American public into fear. And, you know, he wants to deport Haitians. He wants to deport, quote, illegals, these people who are poisoning the blood of our country, blah, 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 blah. I don't think there's a big chance that it won't get better. And to the extent that the United States keeps that politician, that Biden himself, you know, uses immigration as a, you know, he the immigration bill that was scuttled in February, that was a pretty harsh bill. That was not a friendly, like, human rights. That was not the sort of bill that you want in a world that creates that respects human rights. So you see this, like, rightward drift when it comes to immigration.
And Trump has that slogan, what is it? It's like ban Biden,
God,
bloody blood border or something. There's some terrible alliterative. He made that speech, that horrific speech in Michigan, where he was saying, you know, they're not people, they're animals. And he on the podium, it had some phrase like that. I mean, it's not, not as memorable as Make America Great Again, but it has some alliterated B about Biden's bloody border. I mean, and if you interpret it in the right way, it's kind of, well, yes, you know, something does need to be done
right about
the people who are dying on the border, but, you know, not the way Trump means it.
Right. That's definitely true. I mean, I think that phrase, cherche la vie, is so beautiful, right? Because as you point out, it's both searching for a livelihood, searching for a job. It's something kind of looking for work. It's something very quotidian, but it also has these resonances of looking for life, looking for a life that has dignity, that has hope, that has, you know, protection. And that is something that I find incredibly moving. And I certainly hope that Haitians who come here will find some of that.
Thank you, Pooja, very much.
Thank you, Tom.
You can read Pooja Bhatia's piece in the 4th of April issue of the LRB, along with Michael Hoffman on Haldor Laxness, Akshi Singh on the Tata Group, and Francis Weber's piece on the plight of refugees trying to get to Britain. The LRB podcast is produced by Anthony Wilkes and Zoe Kilbourne. The music is by Kieran Brunt. I'm Thomas Jones. Thank you for listening.